Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Easy Conversations podcast, a podcast about having easy conversations, where we talk about mental health, adversity, spirituality, and societal issues. I'm your host, Furkan Dandia. This week's episode is emotionally charged and profoundly introspective as we sit down with Dr. Sapna Shah Huck, a resilient physician who has not only experienced the crippling effects of burnout, but tragically lost a close friend and fellow physician to suicide as a result of the same harrowing experience. Dr. Shah Huck courageously opens up about her journey through the relentless pressures of the medical field, painting a vivid picture of the daily struggles, sleepless nights, and overwhelming stress that pushed her to the brink of exhaustion and despair. As a dedicated healer, she found herself trapped in a system that seemed not to prioritize her well-being, a situation all too common in the healthcare industry. But this episode goes beyond the personal account of burnout, as Dr. Shah Huck also shares the heart-wrenching story of her dear friend and colleague, whose battle with burnout ultimately ended in tragedy. Together, they had navigated the challenging world of medicine, supporting each other through thick and thin. Dr. Shah Huck's colleague's devastating suicide is a stark reminder of the grave consequences of neglecting the mental health of healthcare professionals. Through this poignant conversation, Dr. Shah Huck explores the systemic issues within the medical community that contribute to burnout, the stigma surrounding mental health, and the dire need for change. She discusses the importance of self-care, resilience, and finding support from within the medical community and beyond. This episode is a must-listen for anyone in the healthcare field, those who have faced burnout, and anyone interested in understanding the crucial importance of mental health in our society. Join me as we embark on a journey of healing, resilience, and transformation guided by Dr. Shah Huck's inspiring story and her friend's memory. Dr. Sapna Shah Huck is a board-certified internal medicine physician. She was born and raised in Kansas and attended medical school at the University of Kansas School of Medicine. She completed her internal medicine residency at KU Wichita as well. After experiencing burnout and watching other physician colleagues burn out, it became her passion to look into different aspects of burnout. Because of her experiences, Dr. Shah Huck decided to bring awareness to this overlooked issue of burnout in the medical field through her podcast, The Worthy Physician. While the system does need to change as it is broken, this podcast is a way to reach physicians and shed light on what is not an isolated situation. Please find Dr. Shah Huck's work online at www.theworthyphysician.com or on Instagram at theworthyphysician. And if you could leave a 5-star review or a comment in the comment section at the end of the episode, I would truly appreciate it. Brief word for our sponsors. So I would like to talk about deodorants because I'm tired of constantly replenishing my deodorant and then having to worry about disposing those plastic containers. There's a solution for that. Wild. Wild provides a eco-friendly, all-natural deodorant with a sustainable design. They provide a for-life aluminum case. For me, they sent me a personalized case with my name on it. And did I mention you can customize your orders and have these refills delivered straight to your door? This is an all-natural solution where there's no aluminum in the product, just in the case. Go to wearewild.com and use code EASY at checkout for 25% off your first order. All right, Sapna, welcome to the Easy Conversations podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I really appreciate it, and I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have. But before we jump into it, I do want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the listeners and let us know a little bit about what it is that you do and where you're based, and then we can jump into our discussion today.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. I've been excited about this conversation as well. So I'm a practicing internist in rural Kansas, located in the southeast corner of the state, close to the Oklahoma border. And why that matters, you know, I practice in rural America, and it's a different way of life and practicing, and I truly appreciate it. I think it's one of the things that has helped me to combat burnout, in the sense that there is autonomy here and there's mutual respect. So it's what I've been told is called a unicorn position, because there's a few things: alignment with my values. I work for a nonprofit. I'm in healthcare. I'm a physician, and while I like taking care of patients, I don't think that we should make the exorbitant amount of profit that the medical industry that we see is making off of the backs of sick people. And the second thing is that there is support from the administration, from the C-suite or physicians. So it's a very pro-physician state, as well as medical community. There's good collegiality. You know, I have great colleagues. And then also there's mutual respect between medical staff and patients, which, you know, that's the biggest collaboration right there. Now we cannot circumvent any of the players outside of the exam room, such as CMS or other government regulations or insurance companies. But why that's a big deal to me is because I've been through burnout twice myself, and I lost my best friend to suicide, who is also a physician, back in 2019. She took her life. She died by suicide in her own office. And, you know, that's really what woke me up to, unfortunately, the rate of suicide among physicians here in the United States is about 400 per year. And that is more than likely underreported. That's two medical school classes a year that die by suicide. And that's the highest than any profession. But yet it's dress. So that became a big purpose for me to try to make that discussion more normalized.
I can definitely appreciate that, and thank you for sharing all of that. It's definitely not easy to not only experience burnout, but then see someone close to you to experience it, and then obviously see them take their own life. So that's probably definitely not easy to talk about. So thank you for being vulnerable on that regard too. And that's something we're definitely going to talk about today. I just wanted to, first of all, get your view on, you know, you talked about the financial aspect of the medical industry. Why do you think that is such a problem right now? And you know, obviously people that need the help don't get it at times. And sometimes it's become more of a business than the aspect of being able to help people, which is why many people go into the profession to begin with.
Sure. So that's a great question. And I think it's one thing we have to look at is that anytime you have doors open, right? So medical practice, let's say back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, in a lot of solo practitioners, or maybe in, you know, a couple of internists in the same group. With inflation right now, I'm going to use today's society, our economic status, where we are now as far as a country, and globally, really, there's inflation at about 10%. Mm-hmm. And let's look at that. That means that what we could buy for $100 a year ago does not buy the same.
Right.
And I'm not trying to dumb it down, but let's also look at the fact that now insurance is decreasing reimbursement when cost is going up. And then everything as far as medical equipment or supplies, they kind of have you by the cojones, because you have to buy them from certain manufacturers because it has to go through a screening process, have a label on it that says it's been inspected. And we can't just go buy, you know, for example, pens from Walmart that might be on sale for $3.99. We have to buy them from a certain company. That has also gone up as well. I'm just using that as a very simplistic example. So inflation has gone up even more in the economic area of medicine with reimbursement dropping, what happens is that you cannot sustain a practice when a lot of these, for example, internal medicine, the overhead cost, that means whatever you collect, about 60 to 70% of that goes to overhead. That means staff, that means rent, keeping the lights on, et cetera, not including if you have medical equipment. And there's decreased reimbursement from insurance. There's decreased reimbursement from like x-rays. You can't have a plain film anymore. It has to be digital. That also takes finances. You know, that takes financing. So the expense to run a practice like that has gone up exponentially. And what you have is venture capitalists are coming in, buying up practices, or practices are being bought out by hospitals. And a lot of those hospitals are for profit. And I'm going to go back to the model from the 80s and 90s, you know, to keep those office doors open as a solo practitioner, et cetera. That's still a business. But I say it's a business with a conscience because at least the physicians I've known growing up, I've seen, you know, when I go through in my younger days, right? I'm 40. I've been in college. I've been in transitions. I didn't always have health insurance or coverage. Or if I did, it was catastrophic. So I did work out a payment plan. So the physicians or the optometrists, whatever, they got paid for their services. I got what I needed. And it was a mutual respect. Nowadays, I don't know if that happens, but we do see a lot more medical debt. And that's definitely, it's not ethical. We're seeing the finances of the medical industry being run by venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely not ethical. So we've gone from a somewhat ethical business model to a pretty unethical business model by trying to make money off the backs of people. And if you look at it, we can go to an even higher, 80 to 90% of what affects our health and are things out of our control as physicians, such as what is actually perpetuated in society, and that's going to be a fast-paced lifestyle, always being busy, fast food. You know, there's a fast food restaurant in every corner, and every gas station has how many choices of soda? So that is a lot of what's pushed, and that keeps our society sick. And they get at the most vulnerable, the food deserts. So it's multifaceted, but I think we have a lot of venture capitalists that are driving the economics of medicine, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, I think part of the problem also is it's really the lower socioeconomic status people that need the support, and they're the ones who are probably susceptible to fast food and all of that. And they're also then not in a position to be able to afford the healthcare, right? So it's kind of just, like you said, perpetual, and it's becoming an issue and getting out of control. But one of the things I also noticed during the pandemic was, at least in Canada, you saw a lot of cracks in the healthcare system, especially when it was burdened with people going to the hospital, obviously COVID and all of that. And I don't know if that was something similar that you guys noticed in the US.
Oh, yes. Actually, I think it was definitely mirrored here. We saw a lot of the burden on hospitals, inability to get a bed. I know that patients were waiting in the ERs and would have to be transferred across states. I mean, we're in Kansas, and we had patients, I mean, they were calling straight out to Idaho. And yeah, you get the medical care you need out of state, but what's the cost of that ambulance transport, whether it's ground or air? So there's a lot of ugliness and costs that are hidden, and unfortunately, you know, you can't really communicate that to the patient upwards, and insurance decides what they're not going to cover, what they will cover. And they're always looking for loopholes as to what's not to cover. We can see that by their quarterly profits.
Yeah.
Again, I'm a capitalist. I'm a capitalist, yeah. But I'm a capitalist with a conscience. You know, it makes absolutely no sense ethically to charge what they do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I know. And I align with you in terms of being a capitalist with a conscience. Now, talking about burnout, and I've kind of alluded to the pandemic as well, because that was a huge source of stress and a lot of pressure on the healthcare industry for sure. Countless hours, probably going above and beyond in that aspect, as we were talking about, due to the burden on the system itself. Now, do you feel like that's made the burnout issue more prevalent post-pandemic, and what's being done to support people like yourself that are working in the healthcare industry?
Sure. And those are excellent questions. So I would say that, you know, burnout, moral injury was maybe talked about, but not nearly as at the forefront of which it is now. So the pandemic was a horrible time to go through. As a nation, as a world, but it brought several things to light. One, moral injury / burnout, not just of physicians, but of healthcare workers, because yes, not only was the system burdened, but there was a lot of inequity in the access to care, as we have just talked about, as well as working conditions and pay. Why does pay matter? And for the listener, I will be very upfront. Doctors and nurses are glorified as to income capability. But mm-hmm. what they don't know is that going to medical school, we rack up about $500,000 of debt at a high percent interest. And many of us spend the rest of our lives paying that off. Having said that, there was inequity as far as one of the most famous cases, I think, Lorna Breen, ER physician in New York City at the height of the pandemic, really literally worked herself to death by working countless hours covering ERs as an ER physician. One which she was in, another one X miles away, not being able to provide the level of care she knew that the patients needed because of the overwhelmed system. She died by suicide.
Yeah.
There was a thought of, if I reach out for help, I can have professional repercussion by the Board of Healing Arts in my state. And that is not an isolated narrative for physicians, nurses, and other healthcare practitioners. The thought is that in medicine, we are supposed to put patients first and always. Self-care or boundaries are not taught. They are not really welcomed. We're in a culture of saying yes. And then you add that with individuals that go into healthcare because they do want to provide help. Usually empaths go into a service-based industry or profession. And then you mix that with the moral injury of, I'm not doing the best I can, even though it is out of my control. And oh, wait, by the way, I'm exhausted. I don't know how to process all these traumas that I have seen. There is no outlet provided for me. And if I do go seek counseling, if I do discuss with my physician or my therapist that I'm anxious, depressed, I have PTSD from everything I've seen, when I go and I apply for I renew my state license for medicine or physical therapy or nursing, there are questions about, Do you suffer from depression? Do you suffer from anxiety? Do you suffer from mental health? Any type of illness? And if you check yes, there's always concern about this big what if. What's going to happen? Well, am I going to be investigated? Is my license going to be suspended? So many physicians, and I'm talking from a physician standpoint because this is what I'm familiar with, they'll either pay cash and have it off the books, go across state lines to seek mental health help or a therapist, or not seek it at all. One thing that has come out of the pandemic, and I'm a proponent of this, are the sites such as BetterHelp.com, Talkspace.com. Now, silver lining, I think it's great because we've been able to expand the mental health care across state lines, which is, I think, is ingenious. Unfortunately, a lot of times either insurance may or may not cover it, or it's cash pay. So there is a financial barrier there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, what I'm hearing is there's not a lot of support for physicians or nurses that are perhaps taking on too much or are experiencing some of the symptoms of burnout because there's that fear of if I speak up or I ask for help, there might be further consequences in my ability to practice in the future, which obviously creates this fear and probably adds further to the burnout itself. And you touched on the notion of empaths who typically go into this line of work. And I've mentioned to you, I wrote a paper on from a therapeutic standpoint, like therapists experiencing compassion fatigue and burnout. And that's one of the ways compassion fatigue is the first or early stage. And if you're an empath, you're probably more susceptible to it. And if not checked early, then it can progress into burnout and can lead to fairly significant consequences, as you described early on. It sounds like, as you've mentioned, and I just want to reiterate it, it doesn't sound like that people are trained to be able to pick up on those symptoms early on and do something about it before gets into a full burnout type of situation.
Correct. I mean, I think the medical schools are starting to mention it a little bit. There are studies that show that burnout begins in medical school. Compare first year medical students compared to fourth year and then also first year residency to last. But, you know, a lot of this is an occupational hazard. And I mean, just if we define burnout syndrome definition, feeling of energy or emotional exhaustion, depersonalization, feelings of cynicism related to one's job, reduced professional efficacy or accomplishment. And that is not an individual problem. That's the system in which we work.
Mm-hmm.
But this burnout syndrome, it does manifest differently in each person. And so if you're not one that has a good internal clock, but if you're not in tune with yourself on an emotional side, physical side, which for me it's taken a lot of inner work. We're not taught to do that. That takes time. It's not efficient. They don't teach any of that, you know, that personal or self-care in medical school. That's right. Unfortunate. Now, you had to previously ask what's being done about this. And I think that conversations like this about burnout, more of these conversations have taken place.
Mm-hmm.
There's now the burnout symposium that happens twice a year in February. It was in Los Angeles, and it was sponsored by LACMA in Los Angeles. And I think in November, it's going to be in New York City. Mm-hmm. So it's twice a year, and this has been going on maybe about the last 1 to 2 years. So that's a big deal when you have a conference with names like Dr. Maslach, who defined burnout, help to define burnout and develop the Maslow inventory for burnout. Now, that's a big deal. Another thing is that the Surgeon General is listening. American Medical Association has its toolkit. You have other physicians and healthcare workers that are entering the arena trying to address this issue. And then when I had mentioned about the Board of Healing Arts and going and filling out these questionnaires every year for a medical license, 13 states have either taken those questions off or consolidated to, do you have X, Y, and Z that would impede your ability to practice medicine? That's at a level, but, you know, even in Kansas, we're one of those 13 states. I'd like to think that the suicide note my friend left helped to move that needle, because she died in June of 2019, and October 31st, 2019, I got a call saying those questions have been changed. So we're 50 states and only 13 have changed. So we have a lot of work to do. But even an institution like a hospital here in Kansas could still ask the questions as they were previously written, even though that's not in alignment with the Board of Healing Arts, you know. So it's not just at the state level, it also has to be at the institutional level.
Right.
So that's a big deal. And I know that the Lorna Breen Foundation is working very hard for that, to get that changed nationwide.
Yeah. To your point, lots of work still to be done, but sounds like it's headed in the right direction, and it may take some time. But and just to shift gears now, I mean, I do want to give you an opportunity to also, if you'd like to perhaps expand on your own experience with burnout, and obviously you were very close to your friend there who experienced it too. What were those experiences like? And you know, you mentioned briefly that you've had to do a lot of inner work to manage that. So if you don't mind just walking us through what your experiences were like and what are you doing now to ensure you're not putting yourself in a similar situation?
Sure. So to initially address your first question, I didn't really have the words back in 2016 and 2019 to really put a label as to what I was feeling. I just knew that practicing medicine the way I was practicing back in 2016, which was traditional practice, inpatient, outpatient, consults, getting paged and expected to go see patients on my weekends off or on holidays, getting paged at 5 o'clock in the morning when I was on vacation, was not sustainable. And then to compound that, my mom had a major stroke that left her with dementia as well as the inability to read or write. And she is a retired Spanish teacher. So very, very well-versed in the romantic languages, in the romance languages, unable to read or write in any form. So that was quite devastating. And I really wanted to be able to step up to the plate for that, because family comes first. And where I was when I was doing it at that point in time did not allow me to do that. So either something had to change or I was going to quit medicine altogether, and being a mixologist, pretty good. Right. Then I'm not even joking about that. But I had to change my position so that way I could be with my family. So I did find a position where it was outpatient only, no call, because that fit what I needed in order to allow myself to be present with my family. In 2019, after Dr. Bichter took her own life, and after her letter said that she minimized her anxiety, depression, and denied actual suicidal thoughts because she was concerned about professional repercussion, that hits on another level. I think that was definitely a catalyst to my next episode of burnout, more so moral injury. Because you really think about, okay, I'm putting myself out there, but if I actually need help, because one of the first things we tell patients with anxiety, depression, PTSD, suicidal thoughts, is not just medication, but also therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, first line. Mm-hmm. And we ourselves as human beings who go through brutal training to become a physician, we have incurred an exuberant amount of debt. We are working long hours because we love what we do and we do love our patients, but we're not allowed to take care of ourselves. Mm-hmm. I did not see how that was right. So I really had a point where I had to pivot, and I decided to go part-time. It was either that or leave medicine completely.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to take a part-time position, outpatient only, in the original town where I was working. And what had changed between 2016 and 2020 was the fact that they have a hospitalist group. So there's no longer inpatient. It's just outpatient. And I would say better support from the C-suite because of understanding that there needs to be that work-life balance. So there was a culture change. And I'm very appreciative of that. And that's still where I'm at. That's still the culture here, and it's getting even better. So what does that have to do with anything? For me, that allowed me to not only be a physician on the days when I'm in clinic, but then also I have small kids. I'm able to be a parent. I'm able to explore things outside of medicine that help me feel more complete as a whole human being.
Mm-hmm.
What would that be? Well, a year after at the year anniversary of Dr. Bicker's death, you know, I didn't know how to cope with it.
Mm-hmm.
I really did not know how to cope with that. So I did the best thing I knew, and honestly, it would not have mattered if the questions were changed. I put myself into therapy and, you know, really worked on how to grieve something like that, worked on my own issues as far as being able to understand what I'm feeling, labeling feelings. You know, a big driver for that part was my son, because he was trying to put words, and yeah, he's a 2 or 3 year old having temper tantrums, and I'm supposed to be over here as a parent trying to tell him to use your words. And how can I tell him to use his words and label his feelings if I'm not able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I definitely know that when I say I've done the inner work, I've gone through learning how to calibrate my inner compass, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at what I need to keep my cup full. How do I replenish that? How do I draw boundaries? How do I institute self-care? How do I institute knowing why I'm triggered and knowing how to handle that, whether it's triggered in a good way or a bad way? So trying to stay more even keel and being able to label feelings in the moment, which has allowed me to be more present, more focused, more mindful.
Yeah.
Allows for better practice of gratitude and everything else that's spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
I still maintain therapy today. I'm a consumer of betterhelp.com. It works better with my schedule. It's virtual, yeah. It's on Zoom, so.
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you for sharing all that. And, you know, it sounds like you gain that awareness. So when things are perhaps getting out of control or you're feeling overwhelmed, at least you know, or you have the practices in place to step back and recalibrate. and even be able to have the language to express to yourself and others what you're experiencing. And to your point, that's sometimes the struggle, right? Especially if you're a first line worker, you have this responsibility and you feel that pressure. So it's hard to be able to express your own needs when you're trying to focus on others.
Right. Absolutely right. And part of the reason why I work part-time is so that way it allows me, it forces me to have that reflection time. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? I loved medicine. It's fulfilling. Even though the system is broken and there are so many parts that physicians complain about, I'm one of them, right? I mean, we have our moments, but I truly love what I do. I absolutely love the patients. When patients have a bad outcome, I take it personally. Yeah. When they have a good outcome, I still take it personally, and it's a great team effort. But having the hours that I do forces me to not go all in my profession because it's easy to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I know for sure. And I mean, you touched on some of the aspects where being in this field of work, it does create challenges, but there's also the other aspects that I wanted to add and also get your thoughts. That shift work is huge and it doesn't really, I mean, it does get talked about to a certain extent, but I don't think it gets talked about enough. That's huge proponent on stress and just physiological challenges that come up because we don't fully appreciate how shift work impacts us. And to me, I did it once and I could see the difference it was making on me, and it wasn't positive for sure. So that's another area that, you know, people in your field of work or first line workers in general, whether it be police, fire rescue people, EMT, they're all working shift work, and that can create challenges. And then often the other thing I've highlighted previously on this podcast is how people respond, right? The general public, even patients perhaps that are not often friendly, or and that's something you talked about. It's a huge proponent if you have a good relationship with the patients, but sometimes the patients aren't easy to deal with either, right? And that can also add to the or compound the stress that physicians experience.
No, you're right. So I'm not a fan of shift work. I've done my duties when I was in residency and with my first job coming out, and I won't go back to it. And a listener might say, well, isn't a doctor always supposed to be a doctor? And I would say yes, but we also have to remember physicians, nurses, any police officers, EMS, firefighters, first responders, right? They're not superheroes. They're heroes because they put themselves on the line without asking any questions. And our military as well, our military, you know, yeah. They're first responders. They're putting their life on the line without even knowing you. Wouldn't we want them to be well-rested to bring their A-game? But unfortunately, that's not the case. We know that with shift work, it disrupts the circadian rhythm. And when you have messed up sleep, when you have insomnia, things like that, that increases cortisol. That's a stress hormone. You know, that was great when we were maybe... Yeah. Nomads and running away from wildlife, but the physiology has not changed. Mm-hmm. So this stress of being up 24/7 for a job is praised, but it is false. Mm-hmm. We're putting ourselves through stress that we are not meant for. So it would be ideal to have more budget for those important jobs, so that way we can take care of them completely. And we also know that PTSD, depression, anxiety are high. They're high among first responders. So I'd like to see a budget for that. Now, this is in a perfect world. sleep is so important. So that's why I'm saying I would not want to go back to shift work like that. And if I were a hospitalist, I would not do nights, because we also know that working nights has multiple health consequences even years later.
Yeah.
That's why we had discussed.
Mm-hmm.
And what was your other question?
No, I think that we were talking about the relationship, you know, and how patients show up. And because I think that's an important aspect that often gets missed too, right?
Sure.
And you could see often patients showing frustration or anger. And we touched on it earlier too, with inflation going up and the impact it's having on the economy. You're probably going to see a lot more people needing healthcare for various reasons. I'm sure there's going to be an increased level of overdoses and drug abuse. And that is often tough to deal with, right? I know people, I have friends that are doctors, and they tell me some of the horror stories of dealing with overdoses and then some of the abuse they take at the hands of the patients. So those are things that also need to be highlighted, right?
Oh, absolutely. We've seen increased violence toward healthcare professionals. And I'll be real honest, that's not acceptable. That's not acceptable on any level. I'm sorry you're frustrated, but don't take it out on the ones that are trying to help you. Don't take it out on society. I don't know what addiction is like, but, you know, I think that in society, we've really fallen away from mutual respect. It is more focused on the individual. And that's quite sad.
Mm-hmm.
The way I was raised was you try to treat everybody with mutual respect, regardless of whether you agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm.
And you take ownership on your screw-ups. So it's my fault where I'm at. It's my fault where on the decisions I have consciously or subconsciously made. Mm-hmm. I own that. I cannot control what happens to me, but I can definitely control the way I react to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I will be the first to say I'm not a fan of patient reviews, because this is not a restaurant. It's not a hotel. Mm-hmm. They're not customers. They're patients. Just like mm-hmm. I'm not a provider, I'm a physician. When I treat a patient, we enter into an agreement that the patient knows their body, and I'm supposed to try to figure it out together with them, right? Because this is a partnership.
Right.
I'm in the advice business. I can give you my medical opinion and write a prescription that is within the actual regulations, within the standard of care. And if it's not what you're wanting, I'm sorry. That is what I can do, and I'm not going to break my code of ethics to give you what you want. It's not fast food.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one thing that the patients have to understand, and I'm very upfront. Well, I can do X, Y, and Z. Well, I don't want that. Well, I'm sorry. I can't help you. If you change your mind, please call. This is what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
I am very open about, I am there to inform the patient. It is their body. It's their decision. I'm very big on that. You don't want your colonoscopy? That's fine. I'll book you about it next year. You don't want to quit smoking? That's fine. I'll book you about it 6 months next year. So that way they know that this will be discussed. They know I have to discuss it. So I'm pretty upfront.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm pretty upfront about, don't be rude to staff, and don't be rude to me. We're going to get a lot more done if there is mutual respect. Otherwise, we'll reschedule the appointment until, and it goes both ways.
Yeah.
It goes both ways. If I'm having a bad day, they can say, hey, doc, are you having a bad day? You seem off.
Hmm.
And yeah. So, yeah, you know, we can reschedule when we can be cordial. Again, I'm in the outpatient setting in an area where I've had some way of contact with these patients for about a decade. So that also helps. And again, it's a rural community, so there's respect and there's a different culture of guns than you would see in the city.
Yeah. And I think that is the biggest issue right now is we've lost mutual respect for each other, but in society in general. And it's unfortunate. It makes me sad when I think about it because it's taking us so far back in time and created this separation and divide amongst people. And it's a huge issue. And, you know, I think hopefully through these conversations it gives people an opportunity to think about how they're showing up and what they can do to help, even if they're experiencing someone else being rude or disrespectful, you could still respond differently and show them that you care. And maybe that may get a different response in the future. You never know, but focus on what you can control, right? And I mean, I say that with grace as well, because it's something I try to embody and remind myself every day. It's not easy, but it's really where we all need to go and hopefully bring us closer together, all of us closer together. That's the hope. But yeah.
Can I share two stories real quick?
Yeah, of course.
Has taught me through, you know, inpatient medicine when I was in residency was really intense. But a patient really taught me grace. And I can't get teary. I can't tell a story without getting teary-eyed. So I'm gonna apologize ahead of time. But it was this young man who had come in with just swelling and really couldn't explain why. And, you know, the workup was a bad diagnosis. This individual ended up being in the ICU, having tubes coming out every orifice. I mean, every orifice. And even though he was on the ventilator and he didn't want to be completely sedated because he wasn't actually incredibly uncomfortable. I don't know how he wasn't, but every morning for 3 weeks that I had the pleasure of taking care of him, I'd get called and I knew the case. So even on the weekends, you know, I would cover. And then if I was off, I would tell my junior or the covering senior, call me if you have any questions on this individual, because, you know, I'm available for that.
Uh-huh.
Every morning that I walked into that ICU room, he would write down, "How are you today? You didn't get much sleep." So, I mean, somebody that is in the ICU, really on the ventilator, fighting for his life, took the time to write.
Mm-hmm.
How are you doing? That teaches you a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because he could have been upset. He could have been, why me? Yeah. But he really taught me gratitude and grace.
Yeah.
That was 10 years ago.
Thank you for sharing that.
It's just he was a beautiful person. That's unfortunately right. He passed away, but. And then the other one is I have a pleasure of taking care of, or having taken care of, World War II veterans over the last decade. Mm-hmm. And one of them said to me, you know, we fought that war so that you and I could agree to disagree civilly.
Mm-hmm.
And that still sticks with me today. And I appreciate that lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing both of those stories. And I could see it was hard for you to talk about it, but I guess it's moments like those that sometimes make the job worth it, right? Like when you have those experiences, it makes all of it worth it, I suppose.
100% it does. 100% yeah. It does.
Well, thank you, Sapna. I really appreciate you coming on here and sharing your story and, you know, sharing with the listeners some of the stuff that, you know, we often don't hear about what people in the healthcare industry go through. And it's just this expectation that you guys are there to help, but there's a responsibility on us as well as people receiving care to help as well and show up in a different way and perhaps even bring to light that burnout is a real issue that everyone experiences, especially people as first line responders. So I want to thank you again for sharing all of that, sharing some of the stories and being very vulnerable. I appreciate that. For listeners that do or may want to get a hold of you, are there ways they can find you online or reach out and perhaps learn more about what they can do to support?
Sure. So I have a podcast. It's called The Worthy Physician. And that was, it came out of my grief for my friend's death and during the pandemic, what I was seeing. So head on over to www.theworthyphysician.com. Have the episodes, blog, newsletter, as well as my social links.
Very cool. Well, thank you again, Sapna. I, like I said, I'm super grateful you came on here and shared all of that.
Well, thank you very much for Con for the wonderful opportunity. I really had a good time.
Thank you for checking out this episode with Dr. Sapna Shah Huck. As always, please leave a review or a comment in the comment section. I always love hearing from you. Or subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so. That's the easiest and best way to support the podcast. Thank you, and until next week.